Good morning and welcome to University Congregational Church. It is no secret, I suppose, by this time that we are building a new building. I've been going so often that this morning on the way to church, I took the wrong turn and started out there and had to be brought back by my companion. When Paul wrote his letter to the church at Rome, he may have hit his peak as a religious thinker. Romans is not an easy book to read. The argument is involved and heavy. And for most people, Paul as theological acrobat gets in the way of a good look at Paul the human being. But only for half the book, because right in the middle, he gets finished with the intricate logic and starts to talk about some intensely personal feelings. He does that because he has been very badly stung by some criticism. His old Jewish friends are saying that he no longer cares about them, that he was a good Jew once, went to a good Jewish school, read scripture in the synagogue, then got converted to Christianity, and doesn't care anymore what happens to the people he left behind. You don't care. That's a devastating thing to say about anybody. I remember the man in my church once, wife gone, getting old, who looked around one day and said, "I'm quitting. I don't plan to come anymore." I said, "Why?" "Because nobody here cares. Nobody really cares whether I show up or not." And I thought, well, if you're right, this church is not a church. Because no matter how good it may be at everything else, music, preaching, organization, if it doesn't care about you, it isn't a church. Keep that man on hold for a few minutes, and let's talk about the matter of caring. The first thing is, it's not an option. We have to care. We can't be a church without caring. We can't even be truly human without caring, whether we go to church or not. But there is a problem. We are now exposed to so many chances to care that we can't handle them all. Not physically, not emotionally. Once upon a time, we would, in a week, see an occasional friend or neighbor who needed help. Now, watching television every day, with its immediate and compelling images, we may see 100 in a week. On just one program, I watched a newborn baby twitch convulsively on a table, arms and legs jerking uncontrollably because its mother had taken drugs. I watched an old woman in a shabby tenement, her face vacant, her hands clutching a dirty old stuffed bear as if it were a child. I watched an old man who had once given orders in a boardroom, now idly feeding pigeons at the edge of a city park. And 80 feet away, my own mother, once caught up in all the stir of family life, husband to care about, children to dress and feed, saying to me, "I hope it will hurry up and get dark." I said, why, Mom? So I can go to sleep. Nothing much to wait for except for the darkness to fall again as a sign it's all right to go to sleep again. Every day, we see those things, we hear those things, and we feel something, but the stimulus is too massive. It overwhelms our capacity to respond. We can only do so much. So do we pick something, make a choice, or give up and let all the moments pass? We're not calloused, most of us. We're just caught up in this delicate balancing act all the time. How much can we give emotionally before we are exhausted and unstrung, unable to function in our other worlds of family and business and friends? I think of an English poet from World War I days who said that soldiers could only survive the horrors of war if they drew the circle of their imaginations very, very small. They had to stop feeling and react more and more like programmed robots, a way of being dead while they were alive, so they could come alive again when the nightmare was over. But what about, since I know him best, his kind, what about the professional carer, the minister, for example, who is paid to care, expected to care, never to stop caring? Can he do it? His own teachers think not. There's always a course in seminary that tells the student minister she will have to learn something called negative adaptation. It's just a nice academic way of saying that she will have to be deaf and blind to some things in some hours of the week, like those soldiers in the poet's description, or she will not survive. The seminary takes it for granted that its students already have an enormous range of compassion. People do not normally choose ministry unless they like people, care about them, want to be cared about in return. So the problem is not enlarging compassion so much as managing it. So they explain that the minister must, no matter how much he cares, keep some distance at times, have some space for the recreation of his own life, can't be a bundle of quivering flesh up against human need all the time, has to have some protection. I think of that fragrant soft spot in the top of my children's heads when they were babies. I always liked to kiss that spot. Partly, I think, because it was such a nice symbol of how fragile and vulnerable their lives were, of how much they needed their mother and me. But I felt a little anxious, too, that they were so unprotected, and I was always glad to see the bone close up before they were exposed to much of the world. Well, the same thing happens to us emotionally. We develop a little armor plate, or else the men in white come to take us in for treatment. Take the recently ordained preacher who stands at the door after the morning service. People come by, pump his hand quickly. Good sermon. Thank you. Good sermon. Thank you. Good sermon. Thank you. Good morning. Other people come by to say something nice, but he's lost. He's standing there thinking, I wonder what went wrong with that one. What do you suppose it was that man didn't like? Well, he asks his wife later, what do you think he meant? Oh, I don't know, she says, her mind on something important. It doesn't matter. But his soft spot is bruised. He calls the next day. Did you have a problem of some kind with the sermon? No, he can't do that. Meet another young minister and his wife who were called to a town about the size of Hutchinson. They moved from another state, got in to town late one night, no groceries yet. So the chairman of the call committee invited them over to his house for a cookout. They were so grateful and so glad to be there that they were almost ecstatic. The young minister bubbled at one point, you know, you just can't imagine how nice it is to be called unanimously to a church. And the call committee chairman said, well, it was practically unanimous. What do you mean, practically unanimous? Well, it was about the same thing. Terrific endorsement. What was the vote? Oh, the vote was 300 in favor. 2 opposed. They're driving home that night. He says, I wonder which 2. For 6 months, he pokes around and asks questions until he finds out who they are. And for 6 more months, he turns himself inside out trying to make those 2 like him. By the end of the year, the church decides to let him go because he's been so distracted, so insecure and defensive. They hold another election. Only 2 people vote to keep him. It doesn't matter what you do. Doctor, lawyer, teacher, secretary, businesswoman, you can't spend most of your time courting the inevitable minority. You have to make your skin thick enough to survive a touch of frost, but not so thick that it can't respond to the sunlight. That balancing act again. Let me show you a couple. You know, as they try to achieve that balance. This week, the kids will come home for Thanksgiving. They'll turn the place into a kind of joyous madhouse. Friends of the girls calling, tying up the telephone constantly. Tanner sliding down the basement stairs on a mattress, barely missing a sharp corner each time. Questions flying all over the rooms like startled birds. Do you have some earrings I can borrow, Grandmother? Grandfather, I just broke the faucet. Will it hurt Tanner if he puts the mothball in his mouth? You develop some emotional armor plate against that onslaught, or you don't make it. But not too much. Or they notice. And next time they vote to go somewhere else. So the holiday ends and they all pile into the station wagon and they do the familiar honk at the end of the block, and you turn back into the house, the two of you, you sit down and sigh with relief and say to each other, well, isn't this nice? Isn't this great to have everything quiet and peaceful? And for a little while, the bone grows over your head, and you sit around, and time passes. And then one of you looks at the other and says, I'll bet they're home by now. Let's give them a call, just to make sure the trip was okay. So we open the doors and close them and open them up again, not letting our caring kill us, not letting it be killed, keeping it in balance. I haven't forgotten Paul. He had struck the balance, I think, between caring and other demands of his life. But that is never enough for some people. So they said, Paul doesn't care about us. Paul does other things and seems to forget us for hours and hours at a time. If you want to know how that stung, listen to Paul as he passionately defends himself. I am telling the truth. I am not lying. My conscience bears me witness that I have great sorrow in my heart, like a pain that never leaves me, because I cannot win my Jewish friends. I've actually reached the point where I could wish myself to lose Christ, to be cut off from my new faith, if it would mean that my friends and relatives in Israel could be won to this faith also. You hear what he's saying? Put the Jewish friends I have here and hell between me and them, and I'll go straight into hell for their sake if that's what it takes. I have to think he meant it. But I think that because from all I read of his life, he did something to prove it. It's always easy to say, you care? The test is what you do. I remember one day in a college town in the South where I first taught, we had some help, at times, from a fine black woman. One day, Billy took the children to a movie, then needed, for some reason, to get them out early, so she called from where she was and asked the woman to drive down and get them out and bring them home. The woman seemed upset, but she didn't say anything. She drove down, and they wouldn't let her go inside. They made no exceptions, not even in that little college town for the professor's kids. She could go through a little shabby door off to the left, where only the blacks went, walk up some rickety stairs into a close, stale little balcony, and wait there until the movie was over. Her dark face in that dark balcony, all but invisible to the white faces on the main floor. Did we feel bad about this? Oh, yes. We felt bad. I felt bad. Billy felt bad, and we said so to her and to each other. I just don't remember that we sat down and made the caring take a shape. I don't remember that we wrote a letter to the paper, or that we vowed never to set foot in that theater again. We just picked up the children ourselves and drove home and fumed. And somewhere on the way home, we faintly heard the cock crow. for having betrayed the man we preached. So if we care, we have to do something about it sometimes. Old church, rented church, new church, small crowd, large crowd, meet the budget, don't meet the budget, none of it matters unless we care. We may never care enough for some people, because some people cannot get enough of caring. They are care dependent. And we can't let them turn us forever from other constructive things, but there's really not too much danger of that, is there? For most of us? So I said to that man I spoke of in the beginning, who was all set to quit because no one cared, "Oh, I think you're wrong. People just get busy, have their own troubles and tasks. It doesn't mean they don't care." He said, "You're wrong. They just want another name on the roll. They just want another check in the collection plate. That's all they care about." I didn't feel I had gotten anywhere. One day, a few months later, he went into the hospital for an emergency operation. I went up to see him. And in his room, on every table and window ledge, were flowers and cards from the guild, from the deacons, from the church and its people. He looked at me and his mouth twisted a little as he tried to control his emotion, and he whispered so the nurse couldn't hear it, but I guess I was wrong. Don't be too hard on him. He only said what we all feel sometimes. "Just convince me that somebody cares." Well, that's what I have to do to build a church. May I use your name?